History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned, of course, is that they really don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask the right questions and then invest the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 97-year-old John Stokes of San Leandro, California is a member of that generation. If you've ever visited the World War II Liberty ship SS Jeremiah O'Brien in San Francisco, perhaps Mr. Stokes was your docent, or maybe he helped you out at a Montgomery Ward store once upon a time, or maybe you got to greet him at San Francisco's airport when he returned from his recent honor flight experience. Today we're going to hear his experiences in the Navy Armed Guard aboard merchant ships during World War II, but as always, we like to start back at the beginning. So let's hear about your childhood, Mr. Stokes.
I was born and raised in San Francisco. I went to Douglas Grammar School and Jefferson Grammar School and Lincoln High School. In fact, I left Lincoln. I didn't graduate. Left when I was 17 to go in the Navy.
And there were some things happening around the city then that maybe we take for granted now. I mean, the most iconic visual of San Francisco is the Golden Gate Bridge, but you must have seen it getting built when you were a kid.
I saw both bridges being built. When I was in Douglas Grammar School, I probably was in the second or third grade, and I was watching the Bay Bridge going up, and then the Golden Gate Bridge was a little behind the Bay Bridge, and they had some pretty big ceremonies and stuff for it, but I never went to any of those things.
You had a twin sister growing up. That must have made things fun. Can you give us a perspective on what life was like back then, some of the things you guys did, or maybe the hopes and dreams you had way back when?
As twins, our real names, like mine was John Edward, and her name was Elsie Jacqueline, but they called us Jack and Jacqueline. I went by the nickname of Jack all through high school. When I went in the Navy, my real name was John, so I had to go by John. So I thought, well, I might as well stick with John. But I did get, in high school, that nickname I told you was Swisher.
Well, and you've got to tell us how that nickname came about, Swisher. That's, well, some people may have some ideas. Why did they call you Swisher?
Well, I played basketball, and somebody was looking for me, and I had a job with a shoemaker learning how to repair shoes on Irving Street in San Francisco, and there was a newsboy, and I can't think of his name now, but somebody asked him Jack was, and he says, oh, you mean Swisher, and he started calling me, and so everybody called me Swisher. When they wrote me up in the Chronicle for sports, they'd always put Jack Swisher Stokes. I don't know whether it was because I was so bad or I was so good.
Well, if they were writing about you, it must have been the latter, would be my guess. That sounds like something you really enjoyed. Did you have some ambitions of hey, basketball is something I'm going to be doing for a long time?
No, I don't think I really gave it a lot of thought at that time. And then the war came along, naturally. And
I want to ask you about December 7th, 1941. I know everybody who was alive has a memory of that. But before we get to that, you had a more recent experience with Honor Flight Bay Area. And one of the stops that you made in Washington, D.C., made a connection with your father's military service. And some people might not guess what that connection is. Why don't you tell me about that and what your father did in the military before you were ever born?
My dad ran away from home when he was about 13 or 14. He lied about his age and joined the Navy. And he went through the Navy, and the Boxer Rebellion came along, and his ship that he was on went to that Boxer Rebellion. What he actually did, I don't know, but that was the where I connect with him on that monument because it mentions the different campaigns, and one of them was the Boxer Rebellion, and on the other side of the monument is the Okinawa. So we were in both campaigns.
So this is the Marine Corps War Memorial in Washington, D.C., where the statue on top, of course, is a famous scene from Iwo Jima and Mount Suribachi, but that's dedicated to all the Marines in combat since 1775, and it's got the Boxer Rebellion and World War One and Two, and as you said, Okinawa. And your father grew up in England, right?
Yeah, up until he was decided to come. I don't know how old he was when he came to the United States, but He was an immigrant that came through. The way he talked to me, he must have landed on the East Coast, and he got a job in Canada with the railroad. And at that time, it was sort of a subscription deal. You signed a contract, and you were supposed to stay. But he didn't. Him and a guy got one of those hand cars and escaped, so to speak. And he beat his way to Vancouver, and then he took a ferry and came into Seattle. He pretended he was a crew member when he went ashore, and that's how he came into the United States illegally. But he did get his citizenship. And just a side note there, he went back to England to visit his family, and he decided to come back home on the Titanic. And the last minute, he changed his mind. Thank goodness for me. I wouldn't be here otherwise. Yeah. So then he came home on the following ship.
Boy, he had quite a story. So just to get that straight, so everybody is saying, wait, did I just hear what I think I heard? So he came over, went across Canada, came into the U.S. illegally, would eventually earn his citizenship by serving in the Navy, but was going to get on the Titanic, and something told him, don't do that.
Yeah, from England, he was coming back to the States. How he got over to England, I don't know what ship he came out
of. Well, he sounds like a fascinating guy, and I want to hear your memories. I've talked to a lot of people who were around the Bay Area in December 1941. You're less than a week away from your 16th birthday, and all of a sudden, the world changes a little bit. What do you remember about that day, December 7th?
I remember it was a Sunday, and I'd gone to church. When I came back home from Sunday school, we lived on 18th Avenue in San Francisco. We had a really palatial home there. I was down in the basement. My room was right off the basement. The house was terraced. So I remember my dad coming down the back stairs from the kitchen to the basement, and I was playing around with my chemistry set as a kid, you know. So, and he said, the Japs, I shouldn't use that word, I guess, but attacked Pearl Harbor. So I said, oh, gee. So I got on my bike and went over to my friend's house to let him know, my best buddy, but he wasn't there. So, but that I remember pretty vividly what happened. And what happened after that, the next day was Monday, naturally. And I remember going to school. And I remember hearing President Roosevelt talk to Congress and declare war on both Germany and Japan. Little did I know at that time I'd be in the service.
Well, and probably little did you know how life around here would change, because I imagine you probably had to black out at night and all that, thinking the Japanese were coming here.
Well, I can tell you a story about that, too. I remember the blackouts. The bedroom I had downstairs, that's the room we were supposed to go to if there was a problem. I think we had three or four windows in that room. We had plywood to cover it for a blackout. When I joined the Navy, I was saying goodbye to some of my relatives when it was really foggy, and it was, you know, you could drive your car, but you had to use running lights, not the big lights. I couldn't see, so I flashed my headlights to see. There was a civilian. They blew a whistle and pulled me over and gave me a ticket.
Well, and I guess I should ask you, too, what was it that made you want to join the Navy? Because you could have kept going to school. You were only 17. Why did you want to go in and serve that way?
Well, I wasn't the best student in school. Being 17, the war's going on, thinking, I'll be 18, but I'll still be in high school because I still have a year to go because I had been left behind in grammar school a couple of grades. And this buddy of mine, he was in the same boat I was in. I guess we were just dumb kids at the time. I'm not sure. But his name was Forrest Rhodes. He was about 5'3", and I was 6'3". They called us Mutton Jeff. So we got to talk, and we says, you know, they might draft us out of high school. Because I think they were doing that then, you know, if you were 18. He said, maybe we ought to join the Navy. I said, yeah, maybe we should. So we got our parents' permission, and we joined. I went through boot camp okay, but when I came back to Farragut, they put us in what they called an outgoing unit, OGU, and in that, you waited around for the draft to come up to send you somewhere. Unfortunately, there were so many men in Farragut at that time, they didn't have enough barracks to house us all. When I came back off leave to go to OGU, they put us in the drill hall because there wasn't enough barracks around to house us. And that's where I guess I got sick. It was my sinus problem. And I had a fever and all that. And I was all ready for the draft to go to Chicago to radio school. I was really enthused about that because my buddy, he got a draft that he had to go right to a pre-ship building to go to sea. And he did go through about five campaigns. Anyway, I went into the dispensary. Then they decided to put me in the hospital. And I was in the hospital for, I'd say, probably 2 or 3 weeks. They had a lot of sickness up there. There was a lot of guys dying. Anyway, and after I got out of the hospital, because I gotten back where I was ready for duty, and I went on a liberty, and I wasn't feeling good. I went, turned myself into the shore patrol and told them I can't get back to the base because I'm sick and so on. So they drove me back to the base, and I checked in, and I had pneumonia. Then on top of that, the pneumonia turned into pleurisy, and so I was in the hospital there for about probably 4 to 6 weeks. And I kept wondering, when am I going to go back to duty, because I felt pretty good. And the nurse told me, you're not going back to duty. You're going to California to a convalescent hospital. So I thought, oh, gee, okay. So I went to Corona, California. They had a naval hospital there. They took over a country club and made it into a hospital. I was there probably for about a month. I thought, well, they'll send me to duty, and I'll probably go to San Pedro because I was only a seaman second class, hadn't had a rate. They'll probably put me in the armed guard. They said, well, we're going to send you back to duty, but you're going back to Farragut. There's been a new ruling that we send everybody back to where they came from. So that was a real surprise, you know. So I got on a one-man draft on the train to Farragut, got back in Farragut, and there was a lieutenant commander doctor. He called me and he remembered me. He says, Stokes, we know what your problem is. Your tonsils, we're going to take them out. So that quite possibly could have been it. And so they did take my tonsils out, and basically I hadn't been sick until I got in my old age, you know. So, but that delayed me, and my buddy had already been on a ship going to sea. I didn't see him again until after the war was over, but I mean, that's how much time had passed. I thought, well, I got on a draft again from OGU to go to Shoemaker, California, which was in Pleasanton, and that was close to home. But when we got there, they issued us some green uniforms, you know, with fatigues. So I thought, well, I guess maybe I'm going to an island or something, you know, rather than the regular Navy uniform. So I called my folks, and they came over on the Sunday to visit me with my twin sister, and I said my goodbyes and all that. And then The next day was Monday. I was in San Francisco ringing the doorbell on my house, telling my folks I got 3 months temporary duty at the Fleet Post Office so I could live at home. So that was pretty great, you know. So the time was going. I had over a year in the Navy, probably 18 months, and I hadn't gone anywhere, to be truthful with you. After the Fleet Post Office, I went there to Treasure Island, and that's when I got in the Armed Guard. And that was in 1944. Then I went into a special detail, which was called the Hatchman-Winchman Detail. We were actually stevedores. We learned how to operate the winches, how to load the cargo nets, and so on. And I guess this was something new that we didn't know about, but it was a school they had in Treasure Island that we went to for a couple of weeks, and learning how to operate the winches and how to do tie knots, things like that. So then we got our orders to go to Seattle. Then we went to Kelso, Washington, and we were assigned to a ship. And that was the Saginaw Victory. And it was right out of the shipyard. It was built in Portland. And they were loading ammunition on it. You know, being a kid, you don't think too much about the problems that there might be on an ammunition ship. But unfortunately, the ships were built where they had quarters for the armed guard gunners and for the merchant crew and for the radio operators or signalmen or whatever else. But they really didn't have space on the ship for a special team like us of the 15 guys. So they put doghouses, what they call doghouses, on the boat deck. And there was each doghouse could sleep 8 people. No electricity, though, just a locker and a bed. And it was tack welded to the deck. When we were in a storm, I used to see my shoes float back and forth. So it wasn't the best accommodations for us guys, for us 15. But anyway, we survived that.
And there would be a few more hair-raising moments to survive once he ended up at Okinawa in 1945. We'll hear some of those memories from 97-year-old Navy veteran John Stokes when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 97-year-old John Stokes of San Leandro, California. Maybe you can catch him sometime aboard the World War II Liberty ship SS Jeremiah O'Brien in San Francisco. I have a link to the ship posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Mr. Stokes told us how he joined the Navy at age 17, and I'm wondering, did it make any difference for you whether you were assigned to a Navy ship with an all-Navy crew as opposed to being part of a smaller Navy contingent aboard a merchant vessel like you ended up on, the SS Saginaw Victory?
I really didn't think about it much, you know, for what I had been stateside so long, but I did know about the armed guard because through the hospital, I guess I found out about it. So it really didn't bother me that I wasn't on a Navy ship, but later in life I was on two destroyers.
Well, and another part of your story, I mean, you talked about getting sick because of where they had you sleeping in Farragut, and then the domino effect of that, and months before you got back on track. I'm sure you've probably thought about that over the years, how your story might have been different had you shipped out the same time as some of your friends.
Yeah, I was really looking forward to that, going to radio school, going to the University of Chicago. I thought, having me finished high school, here I'm going to a university. But it was, they had a school there, and I was fortunate to get on the draft. Usually after you took all the intelligence tests and stuff, they assigned you to what I guess they felt you were capable of, and it was radio school or gunner school, and they had me on a radio school deal. So I might have ended up in the armed guard anyway if I'd gone to gunner school, but I probably would have gotten a rate too, because I never got moving around like that. There was never a chance to become a petty officer and so on. So when I was discharged, I was still seaman first class.
I guess the other piece of that, have you ever thought, well, who knows, maybe that development, as frustrating as it was for you, might have saved your life?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I figure the Lord was really good to me. I didn't realize it at the time, because I don't think I was a true Christian at that time. And I'm not saying I'm a true Christian now, but, you know, I didn't... have much worries then. So
eventually, as you know, as we catch back up, you get assigned to this ship, the Saginaw Victory, an ammunition ship. Yes. So if you guys get hit, it's not good.
No, it's not good at all. And we didn't have any idea where we were going. And our first stop was Aniwetok. Then we went to Ulithi. And that was the staging area for Okinawa. And I think we were in Ulithi for a couple of weeks before we got the orders to leave. We still didn't know exactly where we were going, but it was Okinawa. We arrived in Okinawa on the 12th of April. So, and the invasion was on the 1st of April. Mm-hmm. So we were there the 12th day.
Well, and I'm curious too, and maybe there's not a lot to report there, but maybe there is. That's a long journey all the way over there. You're on an ammunition ship. We know statistically now there was no branch of service more dangerous than the Merchant Marine. And you're not in the Merchant Marine, you're in the Navy, but you're on one of their ships. Absolutely. And the reason it was the most dangerous, because so many of them got sunk. One of your jobs is to help protect that ship, right? So were there some threats? Were you always on alert? What was that journey just out there like?
Well, we did have one threat of a submarine spotting. I didn't see it, and that was told to me, and I don't know whether a torpedo was shot at us or not, but that was on the way up. We were not in convoy all the way up to Ulithi. Then we did go in convoy with about 12 or 15 other ships to Okinawa.
And as you said, April 12th is when you got there. That's also the day the president died, FDR, but the battle's been going for a week and a half by that point. What kinds of things did you see as you headed that way?
Well, it seemed to me we were in some foul weather going up there. We arrived, I believe, in late afternoon. Then we could hear the artillery and that. The first morning, probably around 4 o'clock, we had general quarters. And my job was on the 5-inch gun, and I was the third projectileman. They had about 25 of the armed guard were actual gunners or radiomen or signalmen involved. And then they had the 15 of us, and they assigned us two different gun stations, like the 20-millimeter gun. Usually they had two guns, two people on it. With us being there, there was three. So when I was on the 5-inch, we had 10 people on the gun. Now, whether that would have been normal, I don't know, if we hadn't been on there. That was my assignment, was third projectileman. You had a second projectileman, and you had a first projectileman who actually dropped the projectile in the trough of the gun. So, but my responsibility, I had what they call a ready box, and it had 25 projectiles in it. I set the fuses on all those projectiles to different times, maybe a 2-second fuse, a 5-second fuse, a 10 or 12 second fuse, depending. So we had a mixture. When the gun captain called for a projectile, he would usually tell me what projectile he wanted as far as time was concerned. So the projectiles were about 50 pounds. I couldn't lift one today, but but anyway, the first morning, we went to general quarters, and we were being attacked, and we saw this, I can't identify the planes. They had Kates, they had Bettys, they had Zeros. I would imagine this was probably a Zero, but it was coming in, and it was coming in facing the fantail of the ship. They were just coming in towards us from the right, and as it was coming in, it looked like it was heading for us. We were firing on it. At one point, though, he turned, because there was a big cruiser on our port side, and it was the Portland.
So this plane is coming in, and had you heard of or been made aware of this phenomenon of the kamikaze attack yet?
I can't say I was, and I can't say I wasn't, because I really don't remember. But I remember sitting on one of the hatches and watching some of the star shells being shot up to light up the sky. So there must have been some aircraft coming over then. But we weren't at general quarters, and it was in another part of the bay, I guess. But the first morning then, when we got called to general quarters, then we saw things happening, guns firing. But the surprise was that the Portland didn't open one of their guns. I don't understand that. But anyway, after we hit the plane, it landed, I'd say, anywhere from 100 to 50 to 100 yards from the Portland.
Well, so I want to get the full taste of this. So you're watching this plane. It's coming toward your ship, and you guys are all at general quarters. You're hoping to shoot it down. It turns. It's going toward the Portland, and the concept that you're sharing with us is it was going to try to crash into the Portland.
We figured that was going to happen, but as it turned, we fired our gun, and we hit our shell hit the plane. It didn't blow it up at that time, but it hit it enough to where it couldn't make it to what it was trying to do.
So that shell from your ship saved a lot of lives on the Portland.
I would think so. I never thought of it that way, but yeah, probably.
Because the plane would have crashed into it. It might have dropped a bomb right before impact. And I've talked to guys who survived those kind of kamikaze attacks. You're talking dozens, maybe hundreds of lives.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So that was a welcome to the war moment for you?
Oh, yeah, that was exciting. I wasn't scared. I got scared later. No, it was, one of those moments that your adrenaline is flowing and.
What are some of the other moments that stand out for you?
We lost the two ammunition ships before us. That was the Hobbs and the Logan. And they came into Okinawa on April 6th. And the day they came in was the day they got sunk. And they didn't blow up, but they were caught afire and exploded finally after the people that did survive get off. And I think in each case, it was about a third of the crew that were lost, and the two-thirds were saved.
And did you all know that when you were going to Okinawa?
No. No, we didn't know anything about that.
Probably a good thing.
Yeah, I would say so. Otherwise, you'd tell the captain, turn around. Yeah.
And you gave us a little hint there. You said, that first taste of combat is you're shooting down that Japanese kamikaze. You weren't scared, but you would get scared later. What's the story there?
Well, I think as the days went on and seeing the action and stuff and waiting to hear that gunfire made you nervous. After we fired a gun, there was no problem, but the anticipation, the anxiousness of what was going to happen next. Then you get a little bit thinking, you know. But
and how long did you all stay there at Okinawa?
We were there for 2 weeks approximately. I think it was 12 days. While we're there, we're doing our job right off the bat, working on unloading the ship. And the Army's sending out ducks. We'd load two cargo nets in each duck. And we had an Army lieutenant aboard our ship who was in charge of the cargo.
So you're unloading all this ammunition that you brought to Okinawa.
And so the Army, by this time, two ammunition ships gone, they're not getting any ammunition. And what the primary thinking about our ship was that we were going to be a floating warehouse, and we'd stay at anchor for maybe a month or a month and a half. And as the Army needed the ammunition, we, as part of the crew, would unload it. Well, that's all good in theory, but it didn't happen that way because they needed the ammunition yesterday, you know, that type of thing. So what they did, they decided to bring a CB battalion, a stevedore CB battalion aboard, and unload us completely right away. That's why we were only there for about 12 days. So anyway, they came aboard. They were a black battalion. They slept wherever they could sleep while they were on the ship. Got acquainted with a few of them, but they were doing the stevedore work. So they had different size crafts coming alongside to load up, like an LST, an LCI, depending on what was available. They were unloading this as quick as they could. And it wasn't like containers, you know, it was all hand done. And so we lost our job there, but we had our job on the gun, so we were still pretty busy.
I mean, you know that another kamikaze could come your way at any time, right?
We had 32 air raids in 12 days.
Is that all, 32?
32. That's all. So, and a lot of them were at night, you know, so we didn't get to bed much. We were eating up on the guns. We were drinking our coffee up on the guns. So, we were there quite a few hours. The other incident was that this one night, we had some high-altitude bombers flying over us, and when the gun captain called, he said he wanted a 12-second fuse. So I sent one up, and then he give me another one, and I sent that up, and he says, give me another one. I says, I don't have another one set up 12 seconds, just a minute. And I had my life jacket on with my light on it, and by the light, I was setting the fuse. And I set another 12-second fuse and sent it up. I didn't think we hit anything, but we were firing on them.
Maybe this question isn't easy to answer. Maybe it is. Is there something that you look back on all these years later, whether it was during the Battle of Okinawa or before or after, is there something that you look back on and you say, you know, that was probably my closest call, that something could have happened to me there?
You know, I guess in my sub-mind, the Lord was there for me, but you know, I didn't give it an awful lot of thought. And as the story goes on, you'll find out why.
Well, that sounds like a natural spot to take our final break. When we come back, why Mr. Stokes would love to have you visit the SS Jeremiah O'Brien in San Francisco, and what his recent honor flight to Washington, D.C. meant to him. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU EDU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. 97-year-old Navy veteran John Stokes of San Leandro, California is our guest today. When we left off, he'd been describing some intense moments during the Battle of Okinawa when kamikaze attacks had become an ever-present threat.
After the 32 air raids in 12 days, we went back to Ulithi, the staging area, waiting for orders. Our orders came through after 2 weeks to go to San Francisco. Don't you think I was a happy guy? I mean, here, I'd only been to sea maybe 2 or 3 months, and I was going back home already. I had a sea story to tell, like I'm telling you, to my folks. So we were really thrilled, you know. We proceeded to leave Ulithi, and 10 hours out of Ulithi, I remember it well. I was just off a watch. I got off watch at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was on the bridge. And I had my hammock slung under the 5-inch gun tub. We didn't use the cabins much because it was so hot. But anyway, I was just crawling into my hammock, and I was laying there, and all of a sudden I heard this tremendous sound, and the ship shuddered, and we were just off of a truck, which was a big Japanese base, but by that time, I don't think it was much. But you think of that, and I thought, are we being boarded? What's happening? Because all of a sudden I see this big object coming towards me, hitting the fantail, bumping off and going away. And then all of a sudden the ship listed about 15 degrees. We hear boop, 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 abandoned ship. So we go to the lifeboats and we wait to find out what's going to happen. So by this time it's daylight, probably around 8 or 9 in the morning, and we're standing there, we're sitting or whatever, by our lifeboat assignments, and I got to thinking, boy, if I'm going to be out in that lifeboat, I'm going to get sunburned. I better go get my helmet and get some cigarettes. I smoked then. So that's what I did. I went back to where my stuff was, and then came back, and we waited some more, and then finally they says, we can abandon the lifeboats. The ship was going to not sink. It ended up that we went back to Ulithi, and we were dead in the water for a time, and they sent a destroyer escort out to us and led us back to Ulithi. You got to remember, the ship was running anywhere from 15 to 18 knots. It was a lot faster than a Liberty ship. So going back, we only could go about 3 knots. So it took us about two or three days to get back to Ulithi. And then they brought a CB battalion aboard that were ship repairers, and they started working on the ship. They got some big iron, like railroad tracks, that they welded to the both decks, the top deck and the middle deck and so on. And that ship that hit us, it was the Cuba Victory, hit us in hole number 2 from the hatch combing all the way down to the keel of the ship was a hole. The ship that hit us looked like they were an aircraft carrier after they hit us, because their bow was caved in and sort of sliced under. Anyway, I don't know what happened to that ship after us, but they were loaded. I think I saw a landing craft on top of their deck, because they, you know, they used to have top loads too. But so anyway, it took us 3 days, like I say, to get back, and they started the repairs, and that was for about 2 weeks. And they said, well, we were thinking you could get back to the States this way, but if you got into a real bad storm, there might be problems. So we think we ought to send you down to Manus Island in the Admiralties. They have a ship repair base in Los Negros. Those islands almost are together. So that's where we went.
This is different for everybody, and it was a different time. But can you help us understand the difference between that 17-year-old kid who went into the Navy and the 20-year-old who got out after seeing war overseas?
Well, I think I certainly must have been more mature.
Well, and we know that skinny little kid could make a basket or two. That's why they called you Swisher. And you went to college after that, played a little college basketball?
Very little, but I did. I don't say I was first string, but I was on the freshman team. So,
were you using your GI Bill benefits to go to school?
Yeah, and that's when San Francisco State was in downtown, and it was a college. It wasn't a university.
And it wasn't an injury or anything else that ended your college basketball career. It was somebody pretty special that you thought was more important than making baskets, huh?
Yeah, I met my wife through my sister. My sister Helen worked at a store called Weinstein's. So these two girls, Gail and Donna ended up being my wife. I was, like I say, going to college, and my sister rang me up, and she said, "I got a couple of girls you ought to come down here and meet." And my sister was like, she'd taken in strangers like lost puppies, you know. She was so generous, and she took a liking to these girls. I went down and bought a pair of shoes in Weinstein's to get a glance of her. And she was a rapper, so I got a good look at her. So anyway, I took a liking to her. So we met in October, got engaged in November, and got married in December. And my oldest sister told my mother, "It'll never last." She was 70 years wrong.
Well, and I know there's a lot of people out there listening who they've been married a while, and maybe they're shooting for 70. They'd like to be able to say that. So what would you say was the secret to a marriage that carried you for 70 years?
Give and take. Give and take. I mean, we had our ups and downs. I think there was one time we were on the verge of separating, but we didn't. We worked it out.
You were on that Liberty ship, and now you spend a lot of time on a Liberty ship for quite a few years here, right in San Francisco. Some people know about this. They've heard about it on this program before. A lot of people don't know that you can go visit a World War II Liberty ship that still has a steam engine that can take it around the bay, the SS Jeremiah O'Brien. What do you do out there, and why does it matter?
Well, it brings back memories, and I didn't know an awful lot about the ship at first. The way I was attracted to the ship was that I went to a Armed Guard convention. There was 144,000 Armed Guard. That was more than it was in the Navy in 1938. So this gentleman organized the Armed Guard fraternity, or whatever you want to call it. He had a brother that was killed, and he was also in the Armed Guard, but he had a brother that was on a ship right off the coast of the East Coast that got sunk, and he got killed. So anyway, in his memory, I think he started this organization, and we had about 14,000 members. And so when I went to this convention, this lady, her husband was in the Armed Guard. He had passed, but they had both been docents, and she said, "I should join." And I said, "Well, okay, I'll look into it." And I ended up signing up to be a docent. And there was still some of us Armed Guard guys around. Unfortunately, there isn't any more, but except for myself. So I'd go over every week. And at first, there was five of us going over there in one car from the East Bay. And all the other four are gone. I'm the only one left. So, and it's been rewarding. It really has. I've enjoyed it.
I'm sure there's a lot of people listening who've never been to the SS Jeremiah O'Brien before. Why do you think they should? What are they going to experience, or how's their perspective going to be shaped if they do make that a priority?
It is a rewarding experience, and to hear the stories, and the crew is not back in 1940. The crew is 2023, and things have changed to modernize the tour of the ship, and it's far superior than when I first went aboard, this lady has put together a program that you can put on your phone as you go through the ship. And if you don't finish the visit, you've got all this information that you carry home with you, and you can go through the tour on your phone and really see all of history of what the Jeremiah did being in Europe, and the ship goes out all the time. I ended up being a chaplain on the ship, burying people on Memorial Day. And when they take the ship out, you know, it's a wonderful feeling, and we get good crowds, and especially during Fleet Week when the planes, and they make sure they fly over the ship, so you get a great view of that. And World War II history, I mean, it's great, and they got a lot of stuff on the ship other than just the ship. They got the museum, they got a prototype of the landing in France on D-Day, just a great many things to see.
Yeah, so much history to explore in a still operational World War II Liberty ship. Not easy to find those, and you can find one right in San Francisco, the SS Jeremiah O'Brien. You just had another meaningful experience in San Francisco. You came back from your honor flight to San Francisco International Airport, but I want to know about that experience going back to Washington with Honor Flight by Area. What were the highlights for you?
You got me in tears. What an honor. It was just a fantastic experience meeting fellow veterans and being treated like King George. There was only other World War II veteran, and he was Navy. His name was Roy, and he was a year older than I was, and he definitely was in a wheelchair. Fortunately, I'm able to get around. Him and I placing that wreath on the unknown soldier is just a fantastic experience. Had a large crowd there. The rest of the people that went with us, they were all there. They took pictures. It was just tear-jerking. And one of the highlights of it was the end. They had this big crowd greet us, you know. You can see why people want to be celebrities. Bagpipes, policemen, medics, just civilians, just a fantastic greeting. You know, it brings tears to your eyes. Like I was talking to Roy at our reunion, it was probably the best highlight of our life. You know, it was really something.
And you mentioned one thing there that I do want to ask you about, that laying the wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. There aren't too many people who get to do that. What were you thinking about when you went through that brief ceremony?
For one thing, I was thanking God that I was able to do it. Sometimes, you know, that's the problem, being a braggart. You think too much of yourself than you do of other people. And the saying is, love your brother as you love yourself. And sometimes I forget that, and it bothers me that I do. But it just was a fantastic trip.
Well, I don't want to leave out anything that's important to you, but I definitely want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that you're the only one who could tell us that story. I am curious to know, is there something for you when you look back over 97 years on the planet and some of the things you've shared today? Is there something that you would say that you're most thankful for or most proud of?
I think being married. I miss her. My family is so beautiful. I can hardly talk, but they all have an interest in me. And I am happy that I'm able to get up each day. I pray to the Lord at night as I go to sleep. That I pray the Lord a soul to keep, and if I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. That's the way I feel about that. I am thankful I'm alive, and I do enjoy living, and I hope I can live a lot longer. But if the Lord wants me, I'm willing to go.
John Stokes, 97 years old, of San Leandro, California. I want to thank his fellow SS Jeremiah O'Brien volunteer, Mike Savino, for getting us connected with Mr. Stokes. The next time you're in San Francisco, maybe you'll have the privilege of meeting up with them on that World War II Liberty ship. That's all the time we have on the radio today. You will find a few more memories from Mr. Stokes in the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.